versus Evan John Wilson.
Good morning. I'll reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please. All right. Good morning, and may it please the court. Marla Zink of the Washington Appellate Project. I'm here on behalf of Evan Wilson. The court should remand this case for a new trial under Pavlich. Washington's case law has been clear for over 120 years that where no adverse inference instruction is requested and not provided, the remedy is reversal and remand for a new trial. And that's because
Pavlich was decided long before incorporation of the Fifth Amendment.
Correct.
And all that. And our courts have found that the federal Fifth Amendment and the state Fifth Amendment are pretty much the same, and there are federal cases which say it's not structural error. So how does that affect the vitality of Pavlovich now?
Sure. Well, first of all, I would say that in this context, it has not been analyzed that I've seen the Fifth Amendment to Article 1, Section 9, and it should be done on a case-by-case basis.
Well, you haven't done a gun wall analysis, so.
We have not done a gun wall analysis because Pavlich, back in 1928, I believe it was, made clear that based on Articles 1, Section 9, and no discussion of the Fifth Amendment takes place. Of course, it hadn't been incorporated, but
right.
No discussion there. There's been said that reversal is required. We have a strong state constitutional history as well as statutory history that predated the Constitution. So we don't believe a gun wall analysis is required here. The state doesn't even rely on Pavlich for those propositions, presumably because they can't win under it. It's not a case where they asked for it to be overturned. Nor
so what if we look at federal law?
Mm-hmm.
And under federal law, the question is whether it's structural error or we engage in a harmless error analysis.
Right. So to get to the federal question, obviously this court would have to overrule Pavlich or somehow set it aside. I'm not sure how that would be done otherwise. But in looking at the federal courts,
couldn't we say that Pavlich is consistent with federal law because you do have the Carter instruction, and there are cases that are very similar on the federal level?
Well, if Pavlich is consistent with federal law, then federal law requires automatic reversal, and the U.S. Supreme Court has not weighed in on this. In fact, it's explicitly reserved, so it's an open question in federal law.
Pavlich, at least the first Pavlich, isn't it somewhat distinguishable from the facts that we have here? I mean, here there was really no discussion. No one other than filing the request for the instruction initially, there was no discussion at all in open court about whether the instruction ought to be given. In Pavlich, there was extensive discussion about that. Doesn't that make it a little bit different in terms of trying to decide if there's structural error?
Well, I think there's a couple responses to that. The first is that goes to the heart of the state's argument, which is that it wasn't properly requested. Mr. Wilson did propose a written instruction. Mm-hmm. That's all that 6.15a requires, and that's all that Pavlich requires is a request. In order for Mr. Wilson to have been seen to abandon or to waive or revoke that request for the instruction, some express act would have had to happen. And Pavlich says that. Lindbeck and Myers earlier said that in this very context. But we also apply that rule in invited error. And in fact, I noticed that the court was applying the same presumption to Mr. Ellis's argument that just because he didn't emphasize a certain point when he got up, he wasn't revoking that request in the prior case heard today. And the same should apply here. But even if it didn't, it's a manifest constitutional error. This goes to preserving the issue for review. Manifest constitutional errors are always reviewed or reviewable. And the U.S. Supreme Court and other jurisdictions have said the same thing, federal courts and state courts very context.
What's manifest about the error here?
Well, it was both proposed and apparent to the trial court. It's plain on the record here. And the prejudice to Mr. Wilson is clear. As the courts have said.
In what way?
Well, in a couple ways. Both legally, the courts have made clear that, in Pavlich, quoting from Myers, that the court has no right to conclude that an omission of a no adverse inference instruction was not largely instrumental in the conviction of the defendant. And then Carter, the U.S. Supreme Court, that said that silence is inescapably impressed on the jury's consciousness. And without a limiting instruction, the jury can be expected not only to notice the silence, but to speculate about incriminating inferences from the silence. And here, going to the harmless error analysis, The state would have to show that there's no reasonable possibility the error might have affected the jury's verdict. And here we have five reasons why the state can't show that. First, we have major credibility issues.
This is an alternative argument. I mean, first you're saying structural reverse. Now you're saying, well, even if harmless error applies, this was not almost beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that your argument?
Exactly, yes. We believe that this is structural under Pavlovich and the court should end there. But if the court does reach harmless error, it was not harmless here and it would be the state's burden. And that's because the witnesses had major credibility issues. They were under, one was under a plea deal. He was the accomplice. The other one had an immunity agreement. They were both discredited when they were caught in a lie about saying they had not known each other when they clearly did. The state's story didn't even make sense here. They never found the firearm that was the alleged object of the robbery. Smith, the co-defendant, said he never gave any marijuana or money to Wilson, the defendant. Smith also said that he had been mad at my client when this all went down, and yet he spent the next several hours with him, took pictures and posted them on Facebook with the firearm. And the alleged victim here, Rosenthal, doesn't come up with the story until later that night after he talks to his mother. He sold a rifle in exchange for this gun that he claimed the gun was worth about $12,000, and then he's willing to sell it the next day basically for $1,000 and an ounce of marijuana. So I'll reserve the remainder. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Janice Albert. I represent the state of Washington in this case. This case really gives you an if-then decision at every stage. If a defendant correctly requests an instruction that he need not testify, a Carter instruction, then and only then must the court give it. So the first if-then in this case is if the defendant correctly requested the instruction.
Well, he did include it in the packet of instruction.
He did include it in the packet, Your Honor.
So isn't the question whether he should have objected to the failure to give it?
I think there's an intermediary step. Yes, he should have objected. That comes later, though. What he really should have done is brought the court's attention to the fact that the court seemed to have overlooked this instruction. The court never said, no, I am not giving this.
What's the difference between that and the failure to object?
Judge, I think, I wasn't in King County, but someone said you were both in King County. I think there's a lot of back and forth discussions about jury instructions before you have to object or take exception to one not being given. You say, here's the packet, everybody. And that's what happened in this case. The judge says, here's the packet. I want you to take some time, look at it. You have the lunch hour. Right after lunch, they come back, and he says, okay, I put the packet together. Anyone want to talk about anything in it? And there's a discussion about what's in the packet. Once that discussion has taken place, then and only then does the court ask for formal objections and exceptions. And I think that we, being realistic and looking at the record in this case, the judge more than once asked counsel, have I covered all my bases here? Do I have everything here that you wanted in order that I could make a decision about this? Because that's what the objection is supposed to do. It's supposed to give the court a chance to correct an error before it occurs. In this case, this seems like an oversight, and the defendant had every opportunity to draw that to the court's attention. And it also seems that although there was no express withdrawal of this instruction, it seems that that's what the defense attorney wanted to do for a couple of reasons. The first is that this attorney, in opening statement, mentioned that his client did not have to testify at trial. So clearly when the trial started, that was important to him.
So are you making an invited error argument?
Judge, I don't know if I can actually say invited error because it's not as if he proposed the wrong instruction and asked the court to give it. This is more a tactical decision. And now the defense attorney is taking the defendant is taking advantage of what was really a tactical decision.
Well, that's kind of what the invited error doctrine is talking about.
Right, but there was no express abandonment of this instruction. But insofar as it's possible to invite error by inaction?
Well, I don't know if it's by inaction, but go ahead.
Right. That is exactly what counsel did in this case. What happens at trial is often different from what you think the actual testimony is going to be. In this case, the defendant had already made statements to police about what had happened. He told two different officers he was just too intoxicated, he was just too high on drugs, he did not remember what happened that night. Two officers, very specifically, very emphatic that he did not remember what happened that night. So the jury has that bit of evidence.
So we don't get to that point if we find it's structural error, though.
I beg your pardon?
We don't get to that point of looking at what...
No, not if there's structural error.
Structural error. Why wouldn't we conclude, based on Pavlich, that it's structural error?
Pavlich is... Well, there are two Pavlich cases, and they're... Actually, the first one is the one where this came up, Pavlich 1, and that was they were talking about the statute that required courts to give this instruction regardless of whether it was asked for. And part of their decision was based on that statute. Pavlich 2 doesn't really matter because in Pavlich 2, the defendant failed to ask for the instruction and it wasn't given. And that's how you see that it's not a structural error. The kinds of structural errors that happen in instructions are those that go to the very heart of the fairness of the trial itself, like directing a verdict, like shifting the burden of proof, like the beyond a reasonable doubt definition, like the unanimity definition. Those are instructional errors that you can't waive. You can't say, you know, Judge, I don't want you to instruct the jury on beyond a reasonable doubt. I'd rather you didn't.
Could
you just can't waive that.
Could, thinking through about your going, skipping back to the tactical
right.
argument, can a counsel tactically decide not to request this instruction?
Absolutely. The case law is clear on that, that the court doesn't have to give this defendant need not testify instruction unless it's asked for. That's different from beyond a reasonable doubt. You have to give that one. You don't wait for someone to ask for it. In every case that we have before us, unless the defendant asks for this, it does not need to be given. And that's how we can know it's not structural error. You can rely on the federal cases that discuss it quite clearly.
If we then go to the manifest error issue, it strikes me that a lot of the evidence in this case was really contested. There was no, I mean, there were three people who were part of this, and one got immunity, one got a plea deal, one got convicted. It seems like there is prejudice there, unless the jury's told he doesn't have to testify.
In some cases, and described like that, yes, but a lot more was going on in this case than that. First, the defendant had already made a statement that he did not remember what happened. Would a juror expect him to testify when he's already twice said, I was high on drugs, I was so drunk, I do not remember, I have absolutely no recollection of that, even when he's prodded? Additionally, and this was really what probably presented a problem for defense, the defendant had stood silent in the face of these accusations before. He had talked to Juan, and Juan said, hey, Blake is talking malarkey about you, and he hadn't responded. He had talked to Paola, and this is all in evidence, talked to Paola, and Paola said, dude, Blake is talking stuff about you, and he didn't respond to those. So he stood silent in the face of accusations. He then has an email exchange with the victim, and he says to the victim, why are you talking stuff about me? And the victim says, because you pointed a gun at my head. The defendant doesn't respond. So in this case, it couldn't have been prejudicial. It could only have helped him not to highlight the fact that once again, he wasn't saying anything in the face of the accusation, not just from the victim, but from other people as well. So that prejudice prong is taken care of if it was error. If it was properly requested and error occurred, then the error was constitutional, but it was not manifest. It wasn't, didn't prejudice the defendant in this case because of the way the evidence came in. If you have no other questions, I don't have anything to add. Thank you.
You have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to point the court to the opening statement to show that, very simply, this wasn't a tactical decision, if even it comes down to that. In the opening statement on January 26th at page 95, defense counsel highlighted the defendant's right to silence. But the instruction that was requested here isn't just about the defendant's right not to testify. It also instructs the jury that they can make no adverse inference against the defendant, so they cannot use it to infer guilt, and they cannot use it to prejudice him in any way. And that instruction was not given here, and that's the harm. It really goes to both things that Article 1, Section 9 and the Fifth Amendment cover. The state can cite to no case or to any rule that required Mr. Wilson to have done more here. And if there were such a requirement, it would be stated like it is in the Criminal Rule 4.4 that goes to severance, where it's stated quite plainly that without renewing a request for a severance, the right is waived, or the request is waived. The 6.15 dealing with jury instructions here does not say that. There can be no requirement imposed. The court here was apprised of Mr. Wilson's position by proposing the written instruction. That's enough to preserve it for review. In addition, the U.S. Supreme Court in James versus Kentucky, the Alabama Supreme Court in Phillips versus Alabama, and federal courts such as Island have said that we will not let procedural minutiae come in the way of deciding these constitutional claims. The same applies here, and those are all in this context. And then finally, I didn't get to the two additional reasons that this error is not harmless here. In addition to the ones we've discussed, the jury asked a single question, and that was the request for a transcript of Mr. Smith, the co-defendant's testimony. The court did not provide a transcript of that testimony, but that request, like in Burgess, the 11th Circuit case, shows that the jury was carefully scrutinizing the state's case and was concerned about the testimony here. I also posit that the fact that there was a split verdict, that Mr. Wilson was acquitted of one count, also shows that the jury was concerned about the state's case, that they were not just accepting everything that the state had presented. And we can't presume that just because if they had been provided with a no adverse inference instruction, the result would have been the same. They might very well have acquitted on all counts or on more counts, and that's why we need to remand for a new trial.
Given the give and take, as counsel for the state outlines it over the jury instructions, is it a fair conclusion that it was a last-minute tactical decision not to take exception for the failure to give this instruction?
No. Again, we require express conduct in order to waive and or to abandon a claim. And that's for good reason. Where it's a constitutional issue where the defendant had this right, it had already been proposed, there can be no presumption that it had been waived. If the court had been concerned especially about that instruction, it could have asked about it, and then counsel would have been required to decide at that point whether it was affirmatively waiving, which, again, I think there's no evidence of that and no reason for it. But, you know, just the fact that there was time to discuss the instructions, that's the court's obligation. That's what 6.15C goes to. It doesn't go to the defendant's abandonment or waiver like it does in the severance rules. If the court has no further questions, we ask that you reverse and remand for a new trial.